in medicine and provide insights into the human mind.
But the possibilities are intriguing. At the very least, these drugs are worth scientists' attention.
This moment of science comes from Indiana University.
Today's program was prepared by Jeremy Shear, with help from David Nichols at Purdue University. There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amos.indiana.edu. To get podcasts, click on the podcast button. I'm Don Glass.
And I'm Yael Cassander.
In sports this afternoon, top-ranked Roger Federer tumbled out of the Rome Masters today. The Swiss star was upset by 27th-ranked Radek Stepanek, 7-6, 7-6, in the quarterfinals. The Chicago Cubs opened a three-game set with the Arizona Diamondbacks at Wrigley Field this afternoon. In the top of the fifth, Arizona led Chicago 1-0. The Milwaukee Brewers are hoping a return home can help them shake their longest losing streak of the season. The Brewers have lost six in a row heading into a four-game series with the St. Louis Cardinals at Miller Park. The Cards, meanwhile, are coming off a four-game split at Colorado. The Chicago White Sox open a three-game set in Seattle tonight that marks the start of a 10-game road trip. Chicago will be looking for another strong performance from pitcher Jose Contreras. He tossed his fifth career complete game on Sunday, but lost 4-3 to Toronto. The Mariners plan to counter with Carlos Silva. And race car driver Danica Patrick says being dismissed as someone who lacked the talent to win didn't bother her because she knew it wasn't true. The Roscoe, Illinois native is in Indiana this week preparing for her fourth Indianapolis 500. Her April 20th victory in Japan was the first IndyCar win by a woman. That's sports.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic Association, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, Mahomet, Tuscola, and Danville, providing quality health care to the residents of Central Illinois.
It's 2:42. Some breaking news about late-night TV. NBC was planning to make the announcement next week, but the news was leaked. Jimmy Fallon from Saturday Night Live will replace Conan O'Brien when O'Brien takes over The Tonight Show 1 year from now when Jay Leno steps back. NPR's Kim Masters reports on the musical at the late night desk that could involve more than one network.
Last time there was a changing of the guard at The Tonight Show, back in the early 90s, there was such a dramatic battle to succeed Johnny Carson that it inspired a book, The Late Shift, and that became an HBO movie. It depicted the intense competition for the crown between David Letterman and Jay Leno.
You know, these network guys, you know, they can't make up their mind. They think they can just flip a coin. Dave or Jay, Jay or Dave, doesn't matter to them.
Do you think that's what the meeting's about, choosing between you and Dave?
I don't care what the meeting's about. I've given them everything they've asked for. I've given them the demos. I've given them the numbers. If I'm the one going down, I'm going down swinging.
Bill Carter was the author of The Late Shift, and he covers television for The New York Times. He may yet write a sequel.
If things go wrong, there'll be a book, and there is the potential for things to go wrong.
NBC has tried to ensure an orderly succession. Back in 2004, it laid out its plans. Conan O'Brien would replace Jay Leno in 5 years. But as the time draws near, the changing of the guard raises big questions in a time slot that's still lucrative for the networks. For NBC, the issue is whether Conan O'Brien can make a transition from an approach that works well at 12:30 to appeal to The Tonight Show's broader audience an hour earlier.
The challenge for Conan is going to be that, unlike most of these guys who've done the show, and certainly Letterman and Leno, Conan never went around to clubs and performed as a stand-up.
Bill Carter says O'Brien has already started doing a longer opening monologue, which is a staple of The Tonight Show. But Sherrianne Brill, who analyzes programming for advertisers, thinks O'Brien's challenge may go beyond perfecting an opening monologue.
His programming is much edgier, and I believe that if Leno was in a competitive time period, his core fan base would go to Leno and not go to Conan.
Which raises the question, what will Jay Leno do? For 6 months, nothing, at least not on television. He'll remain under contract to NBC while Conan O'Brien tests his wings. Bill Carter says Leno is keeping uncharacteristically quiet about his plans after that.
I think it's kind of predictable what he'll do because of the nature of his, you know, philosophy, which is I'm a guy who tells jokes at 11:30 at night.
And Leno will have a couple of networks in hot pursuit. Sherrianne Brill thinks Fox could land him, but the Fox News shows end at 11, meaning that Leno would get going half an hour earlier than his competition. Carter thinks that could be a problem.
If it is in his soul to go and kick NBC's butt for getting rid of him, and a lot of people think it is, then he's got to go head-to-head for it to be an easy comparison. And I think that's the problem that Fox will have. No matter how much money they put on the table, believe me, it's not going to come down to that.
But Carter says ABC could provide the 11:30 time slot that Leno might desire, and ABC wouldn't hesitate to kill off Nightline. That scenario might annoy Jimmy Kimmel, whose show now starts at 12:05. If Leno goes to ABC, Kimmel would be pushed back to 12:35. And late-night hosts like to progress to earlier time slots, not the other way. So if Kimmel got miffed, he could wind up at Fox, and with all the potential for turmoil, Bill Carter could wind up with another book deal. Kim Masters, NPR News.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. It is springtime, and it's time for a coming-of-age ritual, the prom. And party they will. I've been told the American prom is a $3 billion industry. The dress, the hair and makeup, the tux, dinner out, flowers, limos. At least one school district has banned prom for its financial decadence. I suspect quite a few of the students at that school, as well as their parents, were relieved at the news. Putting aside the financial drain of it, prom is chock full of anxiety. Do you recall going or not going to prom? My guest in this portion of the program is Rob Spillman, the editor of Tin House Literary Magazine. He's the editor of The Time of My Life, writers on the heartbreak, hormones, and debauchery of the prom. Hi, Rob.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, good.
Well, you went to a prom. What was it like?
Angst-filled. I went to my junior prom, and I did not particularly enjoy myself, and I did not go to my senior prom, actually. I fled my high school.
Do you think many people have a good time, or do you think most have not so good a time?
I think it is mixed. I think particularly writers and artists generally have a miserable time because they tend to be outsiders, and the prom is all about being on the inside, and it's a very public spectacle where their outsiderness is on display. And so for a lot of them, it is a miserable time.
Yeah. So a number of folks in this collection rebelled and said, I'm not going.
Mm-hmm.
Why did Anne Hood make the choice she did?
Well, she was living through her mother, who had to drop out of high school when she became pregnant with Anne and never got to go to her own prom. So she lived through Anne's junior prom and went with her to pick the dress and did everything with her. And then having done that, she decided not to do her own senior prom. She had done it once, and that was it.
Yeah. Well, tell us what writer Pam Houston did instead of going to the prom. She had a good time on prom night, but she wasn't at the prom.
Yes, she and her best friend hijacked the heartthrob of school and went out on the town instead. And she kind of found herself on the evening by rebelling.
And he apparently had a good time as well. He was more than willing to say,
Yep. It's true. It's true. I particularly like the essays where there were surprises or where people found themselves, like Mike Albo, realizing on prom night that he really was gay, that it took the prom to kickstart, and coming, as he says, that he was cut off from his natural desires, and then it took the prom to kind of you know, make him realize that.
Yeah. It seems even if you have a bad time, maybe something happens, the light dawns, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even if you have a great time, like Walter Kern, I mean, he took two foreign exchange students to the prom, and everybody in his school felt sorry for him, that it was a duty for him, not realizing the potential that might happen. And he actually did have a great time, but he says that it afflicted my soul with permanent frustration because no night could ever live up to what he experienced that night.
Well, also, though, he found himself realizing or thinking even more than he had in the past that the small town where he was just not for him.
Yes, yeah. Yes. It definitely made him realize what a small, provincial, closed-minded town he was in. And even though he had an amazing time, he also realized that he was not destined to spend any more time in rural Minnesota.
Yeah. Now, Steve Allman writes of his near-prom mm-hmm. experience and the guilt he felt later about not asking the girl he should have asked, Allie Vicklund. Do you suspect that a lot of people have a similar experience of thinking to themselves, why didn't I ask so-and-so, or why didn't I make myself available to be asked by so-and-so? And then they get there and they look around and they think, why am I here with this person?
Right, right. Well, you know, in Steve Allman's piece, he says, being too cool for things is the fallback position of the adolescent coward. And I think I have a 12-year-old daughter, and I already see that she and her friends are very cool, and they don't want to go to school dances because they are too cool, but they also want to be asked to go to the school dance. I think everybody wants to be asked, but and included, even if they are too cool to go.
There are a couple of board games out there about prom. One goes back to the 60s. It's quite retro.
Mm-hmm.
Barbie, Queen of the Prom game.
Right.
It's fun to think about that. And then there's a murder mystery dinner party, which is called Panic at the Prom.
Mm-hmm.
And what an uncool but cool thing that would be to do is to have a party and, you know.
Well, I think there definitely is this sort of retro thing going on where people are throwing proms. I mean, people who were too cool to go to prom or who didn't do it right, who didn't actually embrace the fun of it, are now throwing proms in their late 20s, 30s, or 40s, and actually embracing the sort of tacky fun of it all.
Yeah. Now, when you told people you were editing this book, The Time of My Life, I suspect just about everyone you talked to had feelings one way or another.
Yes, absolutely. Usually there was groaning as people remembered the angst surrounding the buildup. It's mainly the buildup that people remember, not the actual night. For a lot of the pieces I was editing, I had to really sort of psychoanalyze people to get them to remember the actual night. What they remembered more clearly is the whole buildup and who is asking whom and the whole sexual anxiety building up to it. And for them, that was much more latent than the actual evening.
Yeah. Is that why prom is such a big deal?
I think so, because it's the culmination of 3 or 4 years of sort of social pressure and societal expectations. And whether you resist it or push against it or embrace it, it's still a very powerful force.
Yeah. What do you make, in some places, prom is just, it's like prom on steroids.
Right.
What do you make of that?
Right. Well, I think it's the one public coming-of-age ritual that some societies have, and it's embraced by the entire community. And then you throw in the sort of monetary or the prom industry around it, and you have a whole phenomenon.
Hmm. Your daughter, the 12-year-old, when did she become aware of what a school dance was and that whole milieu.
It's just starting.
She's
in seventh grade. But she's also in a band. She plays in a band, so it's a little different from her. She's actually played some school dances.
Oh.
She's a drummer in a band, which is, she's already sort of has an artist's soul because she's playing at dances where she can't dance.
Yeah.
Because she's the entertainment.
Yeah. Insider, insider.
Yes.
Yeah. There we've got to leave it. Rob, thanks so much for talking with me.
Okay, thank you.
Rob Spillman is the editor of The Time of My Life, Writers on the Heartbreak, Hormones, and Debauchery of the Prom.
I get up in the evening and I ain't got nothing to say. I come home in the morning, I go to bed feeling the same way. I ain't nothing but tired. Man, I'm just tired and bored with myself. Hey there, baby, I could use just a little help. You can't start a fire. You can't start a fire without a spark. This gun's for hire. Even if we're just dancing in the dark.
Messages keep getting clearer. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. It's 3 minutes before 3 o'clock.
Earth and sky.
The economics and culture of Earth's rising human population interacts with our planet's biodiversity in a complicated way.
Joel Cohen is professor of populations at Rockefeller and Columbia Universities.
Let me give an example to show that this is a complicated business. It's not only numbers of people that matter here. For several hundred years, Europeans have known that there was a very rich fishery off the west coast of Africa.
Deforestation and rapid population growth in West Africa sent large numbers of people to coastal cities. Cohen said that fish soon became the major commercial export of the West African country of Senegal.
The Europeans had invested enormously in fisheries through the European Union to provide employment to unhappy minority cultures like the Basques in Spain. So the European Union generated a vast subsidized fishing fleet and promptly exhausted the available fishes in the Mediterranean, and this fishing fleet began looking for other places to go.
Cohen said the result was a vast depletion of the large and many beautiful fishes off the west coast of Africa. He said it's an example of how biodiversity effects are due to a complex interaction between human population, economics, cultural conflict, and the environment. We're Block and Bird for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. Mike Solo's forecast for Illinois and Indiana, looking ahead to tonight, partly to mostly cloudy with a few evening showers, mainly in the south, then partial clearing overnight, lows ranging from 38 in the north to 50 in the far south. Tomorrow, mostly sunny early, then clouds increase and a few afternoon showers will develop in western Illinois. Highs ranging from 60 in the north to 74 in the far south. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy, the low 44. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny, the high around 70. Saturday night, cloudy with rain and thunderstorms arriving, the low 48. The outlook for Sunday, cloudy, windy, and cool with periods of rain, the high 57. The outlook for Sunday night, partly to mostly cloudy, the low 43. Monday, partly to mostly sunny, the high 67. Up next here on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu, it's The World from PRI and the BBC. Stay tuned.